name is Lawrence Calamo. This tape is recorded on 8 January 1977 in response to a letter I received from you requesting my story about the grounding of the USS Pollux. I know I forgot a lot of details, so to the best of my recollection, this is my story. I reported on board the USS Pollux at the Brooklyn Navy Yard and was part of the commissioning crew. My first impression of the ship frightened me. She had just been converted to Navy use and had a fresh coat of wartime gray paint all over her. To me, she looked like a floating coffin. I mentioned this to a couple of buddies. The captain, an Annapolis man, was quite proud of his crew when he saw how well we functioned and handled our jobs. We had a crew comprised of very hard workers, heavy drinkers ashore, tremendous fighters, and we stuck together like flies on honey. We had a great and wonderful team. Just before we left for the infamous last voyage, I was ordered to install a heating system in number 4 hold. I later learned that a number of recruits were coming aboard to be transported to Argentia, Newfoundland, and they were to rig cots and sleep in that hold. Ironically, those poor unfortunate recruits never made it. I don't believe any survived. The war was already 2 months old, and the rumors throughout the ship were that we were going to run a submarine gauntlet in order to get to Argentia. Since we were transporting a valuable cargo, the Navy decided to give us a 2-destroyer escort, the Wilkes, a fairly new ship with radar, and the Truxton, a 4-piper built just after World War I. On our way up, we seemed to hug the coast, I guess because of the submarine menace. This phase of the war, the U-boats were having a picnic. The weather grew progressively worse. More than once, we almost collided with the Truxton. The Wilkes was Commodore and command ship. Her radar was one of the first models and was a Model T Ford compared to our modern radars. Besides, the old skippers were not sold on the idea of using radar for navigation. Like all other inventions, some people will not readily accept new ideas. It got so rough, I believe we were fed sandwiches. By now we were in a full gale with winds around 60 knots, and the seas must have been 30 to 40 feet, and the visibility was zero. I believe the three ships were being driven closer to shore. I understand our captain wanted to steer more toward open seas, but the Commodore would not change course. Captain Turnip paced the deck of the bridge all day and all night. He knew we were in danger. The night before we grounded, it seemed like everyone off watch was in their head, taking a shower and putting on clean dungarees. As recruits, we were trained, cleanliness reduces infections due to injuries. I guess we all had the same premonition that the ship was going to get hit, that is, torpedoed by a U-boat. However, I don't think anyone thought of grounding. I also believe that most of the men slept in their clothes, as if to wait for the word to abandon ship. I was assigned a lifeboat watch from 4 a.m. to 8 a.m., the morning of February 18, the infamous day. I relieved the watch as usual 15 minutes before the hour. I remember I got up and was ready, already dressed. I reported to the midship passageway. This is where the lifeboat crew assembled, fully dressed with foul weather gear, ready for any emergencies. My first job was to check the boat engine for starting. Number 1 motor well boat was the assigned lifeboat. I opened the watertight hatch and fought my way on deck and to the boat. The sea seemed a little subsided, but the wind, snow, and ice and bitter cold seemed worse. Sometimes on my knees, crawling, and sliding on my backside, I luckily made my way into the boat and started the engine. While the engine warmed up a few minutes, I got rid of some of the ice in the boat. Again, premonition. Before we left Boston, I fabricated heaters consisting of a metal box with a wood bottom and mounted four light bulbs. This unit was installed under the hood of each engine of the boats. The heaters were plugged in for the whole voyage, and a periodic check of the boats showed them to be working well. Diesel engines would not start in extreme cold weather without preheated air. After I was satisfied the boat was ready, I secured and made my way back to the passage and the comfort of heat. I believe I had a cup of coffee and sat on the deck and relaxed. A short time later, at 5:10, with the ship still heaving about, crash with a tremendous crushing sound while being thrown to the deck, we're hit. It seemed we all said it together. Just then, another tremendous crushing sound and trembling of the ship. No, we collided with the Truxton, I said. By now the collision alarm was sounded, then all alarms were sounded. Immediately, me and some of the men on watch ran below through the living compartments, shouting, "Come on, men, get your life jackets. Let's go, let's go." It seems everyone were up and rushing to stations in full confusion. No one knew what was going on. Collision, general quarters, fire, all alarms were sounded. I ran up to the main deck forward to check out the two 40-foot motor launchers. As soon as I stepped out on deck, it was still dark out. Wow! Forward of the bow were these huge snow-covered mountains. Oh, my God, where the hell they come from, I thought. I was dreaming. However, as the ship kept bouncing with each wave, I realized we were grounded. I fought my way up to the number one motor launch, started the engine all right, but I noticed the boat moving in its cradle. All the boat gripes were broken, so I immediately jumped out, just in time. The next wave that broke over the ship crashed the boat. I then fought my way to number two motor launch and couldn't start it. By now we had lost power forward and the engine compartment was partially flooded and cold. No sooner I jumped out of that boat, she also was wrecked by a wave. By now most of the crew was assembled in a passageway, standing by to carry out orders. Next, it was decided to use number four motor launch to carry a line to shore. The generators were kept running while the engine room was flooding, and power was still on at number five hold. The cargo boom of this hold was also used to haul the boat. The boom was about 30 feet long. I was on deck working when I saw the commotion around number four motor launch, so I ran back there to find my chief in the boat, trying to start it. I asked him to get out. I would take it. He was much older. I guess he appreciated it. I climbed in. I don't recall who the other men were in the crew. I started the engine, and we were ready to be picked up off its cradle. A few seconds pause to allow a wave to break over. Then we were raised about 6 feet and were being swung over the side. When another wave rolled the ship, the boom guy line broke, and away we went. First, we swung way out, then way in across the deck and into the captain's gig, which was located on the starboard side, with a big crash. I don't remember anyone getting injured. Well, that knocked out two more boats. By this time, number one motor whale boat was being battered by the waves and broken half and hung from bow and stern from its davits. All we had left was number two motor whale boat. By now, we've had daybreak. Dark, cloudy, bitter cold, and stormy morning. Various other operations were tried, such as swimming, floating a raft, and using the boom forward. We had a very hard job in getting a large life raft over the side. About 20 of us pushed and heaved on an icy deck uphill because the ship had a heavy list to starboard. Finally, we got it over the side. However, it could not be used because all of the debris in the water. All this time, the ship kept bouncing with each wave, and it seemed about ready to break up. And so far, nothing has worked. Suddenly, Garrett Lloyd, I believe his proper name, came to me and said, "Larry, I'll coxswain the number one motor whaleboat if you'll be my engineer." Naturally, I volunteered. The other crew members were Greenfield DeRosa and the officer Garnus. We assembled near the boat and got our signals together. I mentioned to Lloyd that he should control the stern and let me handle the throttle and clutch as I saw fit. I knew he would have all he could do to keep the boat on course. Ironically, the place we were to head for was about 250 feet away and yet impossible to get to because of the waves and the debris in the water. Now the time came, the five of us got into the boat, and a line we were to take ashore was attached. At the proper moment, the boat was unlashed and lowered slightly, again to await the proper time for dropping. A neighborhood pal, Gus Tortorici, who unfortunately did not make it, leaned over the side and offered me his flashlight. "No," I said, "you keep it. Where I'm going, I wouldn't need one." He wished me luck. As a matter of fact, all of the guys around the davits all wished us luck. We now were being lowered slowly. I got the engine started, and when all movements were synchronized with the next wave, we were dropped the rest of the way. Immediately, the boat partially flooded, and I kept the engine racing to keep it from stalling. I couldn't engage the clutch just yet because we had to unhook ourselves from the boat falls. It was a hazardous and tricky job because the boat was rising and falling like crazy with the waves. I don't remember who unhooked forward. However, I'm sure Lloyd unhooked aft because I kept watching him should he need assistance. If their fingers or hands were not pulled away at the proper time, they would have lost them. Free from the falls, away we went. First forward like crazy and then back like crazy. While the waves were breaking over us, I would race the engine to fight the pull and the push of the surf, and by now the boat was quite flooded. Lloyd was struggling to keep the bow aiming for the spot we had picked out. It seems that Lloyd and myself was on the same frequency. His movements exactly coincided with my engaging and disengaging of the clutch. Finally, we were picked up by a large wave, and the boat was tossed like a rubber ball into the ice-covered rocks, exactly where we had plans to land. With this, Garnus, Greenfield, and DeRosa, I believe, were thrown out on the port side, and Lloyd and myself landed on the starboard side. Lloyd and myself was in the surf up to our waists, and we both fought like hell to get out. We finally climbed onto the ice-covered rocks and crawled on our stomachs up and away from the surf until we finally came to this cleft, with the ground being somewhat level for about an area of about 6 feet by 10 feet. Being exhausted and wet with oil as well as water, there is where we stayed. As a matter of fact, later we tried to work our way out and found that we had to stay because we were trapped. I then realized I was missing my right shoe and I was bleeding from my hand slightly. Lloyd seemed okay. However, after we caught our breath, I saw the shoe I had lost between me and the surf, so I made my way back down and retrieved it. The other three men had finally made their way to the top. We got this information communicating with the ship through the use of hand signals. We eventually secured the line we brought ashore around a large rock. That's as far as we got. We couldn't rig a breeches buoy. However, we were ready to assist when the time came. I could see the men on deck with their tailor-made blues under their arms, their only belongings they wanted to save. Gee, we all loved our tailor-made uniform. Every time the ship was raised by a wave, it came down crashing and made a noise like dropping an empty oil drum from about 50 feet onto a concrete slab. It was very, very frightening. Finally, the ship started to break up. A large crack developed from port to starboard, forward of the bridge, and listed more to starboard. I believe it was then that the captain gave the word, "Those who think they can make it, go ahead and God bless you." By the time the word funneled down to all of the men, it got to be abandoned ship. Ski, our other chief boatswain mate, an old-timer, had instructed his men previous to this that he would be the first over the side if the word ever came. Suddenly, Lloyd said, "Larry, is that Ski going over the side?" "Sure it is," I said, or words to that effect. "Oh, my God, they're abandoning ship." We knew if Ski was the first over the side, we knew that everyone else would follow. As Ski started over, a bunch of men followed. They all had life jackets on. While shimmying down the rat lines, they would reach the oil-covered spot, and whammo, down they would go, plunging through the oil and debris. I saw many a life jacket fly right off of the men, and later found some men dead with their arms above their heads by a partially slipped life jacket. It was later learned that the top lashing was not secured. In those days, life jackets did not have leg straps. I don't believe any man who plunged under the debris came back up. By this time, Lloyd and I made our way down to the surf. I noticed that most of the men were just bobbing up and down with the waves and were motionless. They were either trapped by the debris or were in shock due to the temperature of the water, or both. About 10 men who were still able to fight grabbed the line we had rigged and made their way to shore. Lloyd and I, by this time, were in the surf again, pulling men out of the muck. These men could not help themselves. I was very exhausted and half froze myself. While lying on my stomach, I would lock my hand on the upper arm and ask the guy to do the same to me. I would then try to pull him out. If the man didn't budge, I would say, "Let go. I can't get you out." The poor soul would cry, "Try again, Larry. Try again. You know me. Help me. Don't leave me here," and so forth. I would try again, but again, I had to let go. I first looked for my friends, but Lloyd yelled over to me, "Take anyone. One life is as good as another." In the meantime, Lloyd was having his own problems pulling the men out. I remember one guy, Tom McCarron, when I finally reached him, we locked arm and elbow while, again, lying on my stomach. After a few minutes of pushing and pulling, he gave up. "Let me go, Larry. Let me die. Leave me alone." He was so helpless and froze, he just wanted to die. In order to get him out, I riled him up a bit by calling him names. I started yelling, "Come on, you Irish bastard. Pull, you son of a bitch." I made him so mad he started moving, and then more violently. So, finally, I got him out. With all my name calling, when we got home, he had a party in my honor. I guess we pulled out about 7 or 8. We could not reach the rest of the men. They just bobbed in place and I guess froze to death. This wasn't easy to witness, believe me. We all made our way up to the cleft, some crawling, some we pushed up while on our hands until we got there. One of the better-shaped survivors, I believe he was a gunner's mate because I seem to remember he had sidearms on. He started a small fire. I don't remember what we burned. I do recall a small fire. We now had about 16 or 17 men, and none of us could really feel the heat from the small fire. Eventually, men started dying. I now learned that freezing to death is very easy and quiet. It seems you just get tired from a lack of circulation and go to sleep. As we sat around in a circle, a guy would get suddenly very quiet and wouldn't answer. A little shove and over he would go, deader than a doornail. I don't remember how many froze in the cleft. I do remember one guy, the only guy, going berserk and started to kick at the fire. The gunner's mate drew his .45 and was about ready to shoot him when he calmed down. By now there were no signs of rescue for us, and we didn't know what was happening to Greenfield, DeRose, and Garnes. We weren't even aware that the men had made their way off the forward end of the ship. I guess I thought we were the only survivors. The fire had just about gone out, and here it was nightfall, and I had a hard time keeping my eyes open. I was still very wet, covered with oil. Lloyd, sensing this was it, shook my hand and said, "Goodbye, Larry. I guess I wouldn't be seeing you anymore." And I probably said the same thing to him. We wished each other luck and sat down. We knew if we fell asleep, we would freeze to death. I sat with my arms on my knees and my head on my arms. I know I fell asleep, but I don't know for how long. Suddenly, I was awakened by a very loud noise of rocks and ice falling. I looked up. By now, it was difficult to open my eyes due to my weakness and oil on my face. What little I could see, I saw what I thought was a miracle, an angel from heaven, or God himself. Finally, I came to my senses. There was a giant of a man in a naval uniform. I believe he was a warrant officer. Later, I learned he was part of the Navy rescue team sent from Argentia. I also learned that he was told we were down in the cleft. Most of the men who stayed on board and went off forward via breeches buoy were on top of the mountain around a huge fire. All this time, a young ensign built like a football player, I believe his name was Brown, asked for volunteers to help him rescue us in the cleft. That is before the Navy rescue party arrived. But no one volunteered, and he called them all a bunch of yellow bastards. I guess the men were weak and cold. I couldn't blame them for that. Getting back to the cleft, the men were secured with a line and raised up one at a time. I was the last one up. That is, of the live ones. The dead ones were really last. On my way up, all I could think of was some hot food and a warm place. When I reached the top, what a tremendous letdown. All I could see was more snow and ice. I finally saw a fire. Slowly, with some help from the rescue party, I made my way to the fire. When I got there, I was happy to see that more men had made it, including our captain and more of my buddies. I was so tired, I just fell there, and I guess I went to sleep. At daybreak, I was awakened, and what little I could open my eyes, all I saw was a snow-covered wilderness. We were told the village was about 10 miles away. Those who couldn't walk it would be carried by dog sleds. The natives that helped the men from the forward part of the ship had brought the sleds with them. We started towards the village, I believe with the natives as guides. We walked in somewhat of a single line and stepped in the footsteps ahead. The snow was quite soft. Occasionally a few of us would fall and we were helped up. I don't know how long we marched. Finally, we came to a village, which I learned later was St. Lawrence. The group was then split up and brought to various homes. Gee, the heat inside felt good. The generous natives gave us whatever they had. I remember getting a bowl of soup. I don't know what kind, but it tasted like heaven. By now, I started to get back some of my strength. If I could only open my eyes a bit more without pain, I would be all right. After we had some food, one at a time, we were brought into a room. A lady and daughter was there waiting for me. They helped me with my clothes off. At first I refused, but they insisted. They did the best they could to clean the oil from my body and then gave me some dry clothes. I was given a large pair of dungarees, two left boots, and a captain's blue uniform coat. At first, I refused the coat, but was forced to put it on because there weren't any more dry clothes. Well, here I was, a 21-year-old fireman, first class, with a beard. We all had grown beards for this trip. And a commander's coat, but which I recall three ribbons over the left breast pocket. Later we were told to board a waiting truck. As I walked out of the house, the truck driver called to me to come sit in front with him. I guess he thought I was a real commander. I appreciated riding in front because it was an open truck. As we approached the waterfront, I noticed a pier and a couple of Navy minesweepers tied up. I learned later that they were sent from Agentia to pick us up. When we started to board the minesweepers, the skipper, I guess a lieutenant, came running down from the bridge. He put his arm around me and said, "This way, Captain." I guess he was personally going to take care of me. I told him I was a fireman first class. He laughed and thought it was a big joke. And then he dropped me like a hot potato. So I followed the rest of the men. Some went into the engine room to warm up. I landed down in the mess deck. The crew immediately started the breakout chow and did their best to cheer us up a bit. I was told to sit at the head of the table because I was the most senior man. In fact, they said they had never had a commander eat chow with them. It was hard for me and the rest of the guys to laugh. I was still thinking of the guys we left behind, and my eyes were very, very sore from the fuel oil. Finally, we pulled alongside of the prairie, which was tied up to a pier at Agentia Naval Base, our original destination. A brow was rigged, and we disembarked from the minesweeper. Again, we followed each other in single file. We walked through the hatch in the side of the ship, which led us through the machine shop. It seemed like the whole ship's company assembled there to watch us come aboard. A passage was kept open for us to walk through. As I approached a ladder and proceeded to go up, my eyes were half open and I was looking straight forward. As I came near the top, I saw a few pairs of feet with shined shoes. As I got to the next steps, I saw uniforms with a ton of stripes on them. Waiting on the landing was an admiral. I don't know his name. I guess he was a senior officer present afloat, the captain of the ship, a four-striper, a couple of other three-stripers, and other officers. As soon as I set foot upon the landing, the admiral placed his arm around my shoulder and with his right hand shook mine and said, "How are you, Captain? How do you feel?" I said, "Sir, I am a fireman first class," and he dropped me like a hot potato. So I continued to follow the men, and we walked off the quarterdeck down a gangway to a dispensary nearby. When I got to the dispensary, again, a big fuss over me by the CO, a three-striped doctor. I told him who I was, and he laughed. I guess I looked like a clown the way I was dressed. I told him my name, and he said, "Oh boy, an Italian." I said, "Yes." He then said, "I must like a salami." And I said, "I did." He went away and came back with a large salami sandwich, a piece of apple pie, and a cup full of brandy. Boy, what a meal that was. I never did find out if he also was an Italian. However, the next morning, he didn't make me too happy. He ordered me to shave my beautiful beard because his policy at that dispensary was no treatment unless clean shaven. Later, I learned that some guys from my neighborhood had gone to my house to tell my mother the story of the ship that they heard was sunk and that all men were lost. Now my mother started to yell at them and ordered them out of the house. She didn't believe them. After all, she didn't hear it officially. I always told my mother that no news was good news, and if she didn't hear it officially, then I would be all right. When I got home on survivor's leave, my mother mentioned to me how on that fatal morning, at exactly 5:10, she was awakened from a deep sleep. She trembled and jumped out of bed. She knew I was in trouble. and said a prayer in front of the picture of a saint she had in the bedroom and couldn't go back to sleep. She woke up my father, and I believe my sisters and brothers were awakened from the commotion. She told him something had happened to me, but I think he's all right. I guess this is what you call mother's intuition. I also learned later that Captain Turner was crying when he saw the men helplessly dying in the water and stopped the rest of the men from going over the side. In 1944, while attached to submarines, I was awarded a Navy Letter of Commendation and Medal from the Commander-in-Chief Atlantic Fleet for my effort. Casey, I'm sending you my scrapbook in lieu of the sketch you requested. If you should still want the sketch, I'll try to comply. I wish you great luck and success with the book. The story of the three ships, especially the Truxton and Pollux, should make a very exciting book. Feel free to call on me again. I'm looking forward to reading your book. So long and good luck once again. It officially. I always told my mother that no news was good news, and if she didn't hear officially, then I would be all right. When I got home, my mother mentioned to me how on that fatal morning, at exactly 5:10 in the morning, she was awakened from a deep sleep. She trembled and jumped out of the bed. She knew I was in trouble. She then proceeded to say a prayer in front of a picture of a saint she had in the bedroom and couldn't go back to sleep. She woke up my father, and I believe in a commotion my sisters and brothers were awakened also. She told them something had happened to me, but I think he's all right. I guess this is what you call mother's intuition. I also learned later that Captain Turner was crying when he saw the men dying in the water and stopped the rest of them from going over the side. Another incident, a plane flying around the wreckage a couple of days later had spotted a guy, which later we learned was Wiltrout, a coxswain, on some rocks, still alive. However, I don't recall if they ever got him. I know he was listed as dead. In 1944, while attached to submarines, I was awarded the Navy Letter of Commendation and Medal from the Commander-in-Chief Atlantic Fleet for my efforts aboard the grounded Pollux. Casey, I'm sending you my scrapbook in lieu of the sketch you requested. If you should still want the sketch, I'll try to comply. I wish you great luck and success with the book. The story of the three ships, especially the Truxton Pollux, should make a very exciting book. Good luck once again. Larry Calamo.